Here with author, podcaster, broadcaster, and perennial cool girl, Noelle McCarthy, who has a new book out. Stakes is a memoir about Dracula and the secret to happiness. Morena, Noelle, welcome.
Morena, Emma, what a great tune.
I know, I had to.
I am sitting here buzzing out on 95 PFM to Bela Lugosi's Dead. This is so good. And I don't even have to read the news headlines.
No, you don't have to do anything. You're here purely as talent.
I was getting ready to go. It's 11:30, 95 BFM, and the news. But now I don't need to do that. Thank you for having me. It's amazing to be here.
Thank you for coming in. Now, you're here to talk about your new book. How does it feel to have this out in the world?
Oh, the relief is real. The relief is so real. I never thought I was going to finish this book.
Because you've been working on it for about 3 years, is that right?
Yeah, and intensively, I guess, for about a year. Yeah. So this time last year, I was writing this and thinking, one day, but I'd actually given up all hope. Yeah. So I was in a place of very creative despair with this book this time last year. So it is miraculous to be here with you.
And you had the launch party at Goblin last night.
Yeah, we did. You were there.
I was there. It was a very good venue and the theme was 90s goth and a lot of people dressed accordingly. And there was a live performance by yourself, Tom Sainsbury, Toby Manhire and Mo and Joe.
We're starting a troupe.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, we're starting a troupe. For those who are listening who weren't there last night, thank you for coming, Emma.
My pleasure.
And can I just say thank you for all you do for Tamaki Makaurau because, you know, you have brought so much life to this city.
Oh, you know? Stop it.
bringing back the undead in lots of ways. I think that the spirit of late nights and early mornings.
Yeah, we're all about resurrections.
Yeah, we are. And you're here and you're magnificent. Your listeners can't see you. I mean, they can on Instagram maybe. Yeah. But if you can't see Emma right now, she's wearing the most magnificent Roisin Dove skirt with a Marilyn Sainty archive knitwear cardigan.
And it's all red.
And it's all red.
The colour of blood, the colour of BFM.
Crimson scarlet like the bee. It's amazing. I saw you through the crowd. I was buried behind a pile of books last night because nobody tells you, like, a book party, I think if it goes well, is like your funeral.
Yeah.
Except you get to see and hear it. And then they bury you behind a big tower of books. So I just got to sit there signing my name over and over again and watching people have a party. And I could see you in the background. But it was great. No, it was amazing. And Tom Sainsbury and I, maybe 11 years ago, because this Dracula thing in my life isn't new. Like when
we're gonna get into that. How long this has been a fixation for you?
Such a long time. Like when I was here back in when was I here? 2003, 2004. Camilla Martin, Breakfast, R.I.P. Katie Fisher, the producer, Alice Murray, Charlotte Ryan. These are the women of my generation. I was boring them with the gothic. And back in 2011, Tom Sainsbury and I had a go at trying to write a screenplay about Bram Stoker and Bram Stoker's intense relationship with his employer. This is great music to have in the background of that. Henry Irving, who was one of the great Shakespearean actors of the Victorian age. And there was a deeply intense relationship between those two, which, as history records it, is a professional relationship. But Tom and I kind of took that ball and ran with it.
Yeah.
In terms of the emotional intensity. So what we presented last night was a first draft that I found in my G Docs, which is basically, imagine heated rivalry with vampires.
Yeah.
So that was kind of an honor of pride as well.
And because Bram Stoker and his famous creation Dracula play a very pivotal role in this book, even though it is a memoir. Why Dracula, Noelle?
It was always Dracula, Emma. I mean, what time is it? It's nearly midday, but we can probably say the word sexual fantasy, I think.
It's after 10. I think it's pretty good. You can even say the F word, possibly even.
Oh,
but we'll go with sexual fantasy.
Yeah, we'll go with sexual fantasy because the BSA is still around, I know, just for the next few months anyway. 14 years old, reading Dracula in Ireland in 1992. It was that winter that Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You was number one for maybe 300 years.
Yeah.
And I left my bedroom window open for the vampire after reading Dracula for the first time. Spoiler alert, he never came. He still hasn't come, but I'm still leaving that window on the latch. And so this book is about fantasy and reality and the tension between fantasy and reality. I touch on some of these themes in my first book, Grand, but Stakes is really about the gothic as a mirror, the gothic as a way of understanding some of the themes that have kept surfacing in my life, you know, things like sexual attraction, intoxication,
appetites,
unruly appetites, all of these things. The gothic is a very fruitful lens through which to look at them. But of course, unlike vampires, as mortal beings, we are aging and getting older. And that's complicated my relationship with the vampire. So I'm sort of tracking that too.
Yeah. And you also come from Ireland, from Cork. My family's from Cork as well.
Gleeson.
Originally.
Yes.
And it's a very gothic country. Very old. Blood soaked. I think you've used the word.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's a place with a bloody history, and certainly in recent times with a history of the violence and subjugation of women's bodies in particular. You know, I'm looking at that legacy of trying to control women's sexuality. And that is something that Ireland's very much reckoning with now. You know, these things are coming into the open. What happened to women who, you know, the phrase was outside of wedlock, these women who had children who became pregnant outside of wedlock. And it didn't just happen in Ireland. I mean, this happened all over the world, including in Aotearoa, New Zealand. But the ways in which women's bodies were policed and people tried to control them, and how my own personal experience of that, like, I wasn't trying to write this book as an academic or an expert, because I'm not either of those things. I was looking at the ways in which this reverberates really personally for me, like inside my body.
Yeah, and in the book you sort of process the sort of news stories that come out about the mother and baby homes and Me Too, and grapple with your own history of sort of sexual experiences, good and bad.
Yes.
Well, as far as the vampire framework goes, what did your publishers think when you sort of pitched this to them?
I can't remember. It was so long ago. No, they were great. Yeah. Because there was a little bit of this in my first book, Grant. Mm. You know, I talk about opening the window for Dracula and wanting him to come. So it was there. And the thing about this book was, in my head, this was always going to be the first book I ever wrote. You know, this was the book I wanted to write. I had signed up to do a thesis. This is where BFM comes into the picture, actually. Because I signed up to do a thesis, an MPhil thesis at the University College in Cork, and I was about a year into it working in restaurants when I thought, do you know what I really want to do is get as far away from Cork as I can for a year. And Ireland and New Zealand have a reciprocal holiday visa arrangement, so I came out here on a holiday visa in 2001, a 1 year working holiday visa. And I worked at Prego, Ponsonby Road, shout out, represent. I want to talk about Brandon Marlowe, actually, the maitre d' at Prego, because Bela Lugosi's Dead was one of the songs. He used to make me mixtapes on CD, which I played at BFM, because I used to bring up the tape. It was a compact disc.
Yeah.
Back in the mists of time. And Brandon put Bela Lugosi's Dead on one of those. But I was working at Prego and having the time of my life. It was an America's Cup year. It was fantastic. Mm. And seeing lots of Italian sailors with great shoes. And and then I realized that doing a thesis in 19th century popular Gothic was, you know, a great idea in terms of mental stimulation, but maybe not in terms of a career. And somebody said, oh, you could go up to BFM and get some experience, because I wanted to do a journalism master's in Ireland and you needed some experience. And they said, you could go to BFM. They take volleys.
Yeah.
So came up here, and it's amazing to be here.
Walked up the stairs,
same stairs I've just walked up, sat outside in the squeaky couch.
Yep.
On reception, got a form from, it was Sean, the great Sean, who used to be our receptionist out front. Aaron Carson was in his office, but the door was closed, station manager. Somebody handed me a volley form, filled it out. Renee Mundy, who's in New York right now, shout out Renee, was the volunteer coordinator, news and editorial director, and gave me my first shift, which was writing breakfast news for Hugh Sunday's breakfast show.
Wow.
One day, the newsreader, I can't remember who it was, but they didn't come home from Caliber. They stayed out and they put me on air.
Were you terrified?
Oh my God, I left my body.
Yeah.
I can't remember. And I remember there was a story about espionage, about spying, and I had never seen it before. So I said, a spokesperson for M16 in London says, and the listeners very kindly texted in to explain the difference between MI5 and MI6. So that remains one of the most embarrassing things I've ever done on air. But yeah, that was that. I was hooked. You know what it's like. Yeah. It's better than drugs. It's better than sex. Live radio.
And you've got a direct line into people's heads.
That's right.
It feels quite Dracula, actually.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, it's forceful and potent.
Yeah.
So I stayed here. But, you know, I had always thought I really do want to write, but Auckland was full of distractions, full of intoxicating distractions for quite some time for me. But this book was always going to be the book that I wanted to write. It felt like a debt to my thesis and to all the work that I'd done in my life. But as it turned out, Grand was the first book that I wrote. So when it came time, to answer your question finally, to pitch a second book, I think my publishers, who are incredibly progressive, open-minded, elegant women, were willing to work with me on this book and what it could be, and push me to go, okay, we've got the vampire. How can we go past that? How can we say something that is relatable and relevant? And what do you need to say that feels urgent? And find, you know, where it was that the vampire lived for me, and it was in my body.
Mm.
You know, it was something visceral, and it was something about shame. And a meditation on men and women and sex in this moment, you know, in this moment that we find ourselves in, where the ground has shifted in recent times, but maybe it hasn't shifted that much. I'm not sure.
I mean, yeah. And the sort of concept of the vampire in the book also serves to... It's also positive because it gives you a sort of way of understanding the sort of early adolescent desires.
Yes.
And, you know, which is quite hard for teenagers to grapple with the best of times and sort of that idea of, yeah, appetites and wanting someone and scary to enter that part of your life. And I think you do that quite well in the book, sort of
teenage girl. Yes, teenage girls are terrifying, I'd say. They're terrified and terrifying. Yep. And I think that's so much about where fear and desire live together. Mm. You know, our repudiation of innocence and the wanting of experience and where that leads us.
And how that might change us and we can never go back.
Yes.
Once you've crossed the threshold or the window or whatever it is, like you're eternally changed.
That's exactly right. And you can't have it back. And maybe later in life, you might look back and start to feel that it's more than regret, isn't it? Like it's a yearning. Yeah. I love that yearning feeling. I made a playlist for this book and I listened to Tori Amos a lot, you know, and there was so much in Cornflake Girl and in Under the Pink in general, you know, that made me think of that yearning time. And I listened to Madonna's True Blue album because that was the first cassette I was ever given, you know, kind of as a teenager. And that song Live to Tell, which is so overblown in the 80s in the production of it. And the Stone Roses were really important. You know, there were all of these seminal albums, which I can date my life to, as we do.
And they sort of imprint on you.
Yeah.
It is a very personal book, quite raw, and you deal a lot with sexuality, sex, consensual and otherwise, good and bad. How hard was it to sort of open up that side of your life?
It's really funny. I was saying to someone last night, it's like everyone read my diary. And it's like everyone read my diary because I gave them my diary.
You're like, here it is.
No, it wasn't that hard once I had decided that would be what was at stake, if you like. Sorry, I didn't mean to do a pun. But, you know, I remember my husband saying to me, if you're going to do this, if you're going to write about the vampire, you're going to need to wrestle. You're going to need to get down in the dirt and roll around with this. And so I knew I was going to do that. And there was very little sex in my first book, not on purpose, but just there wasn't that much. But it's part of our human experience, isn't it? Like you can't. And for me, thinking about the vampire, the potency of his sexuality and what he represents in terms of sex and danger and desire, I had to bring myself to that party. You know, and part of the reason I write memoir is to understand myself, because there's a lot of things I do that I don't understand. And a lot of my life, you know, I'm looking at in this framework, trying to understand it in relation to the Gothic, in relation to my own desires, my own confusing desires sometimes. And, you know, I love the word raw because I love raw things in general, you know, whether it's sashimi or mittles. But this wasn't raw in the sense that pretty much everything in this, apart from the last sections in Whitby, and that was a couple of years ago that I went there to England. But most of the events in this book take place a good sort of 10 years, 15 years, 20 years ago, around the time, you know, that I was here at BFM. So I have had time to process and I have had time to think about it. And that was really important for me because I didn't want to be trying to emotionally process this stuff. You know, I've done that. What I was trying to do was make an artful story out of them. And in order to do that, I think you do need a little bit of emotional distance. I didn't write it like I had emotional distance. I wrote it so that you, the reader, would experience what I was experiencing in real time.
Yeah, it's present tense rather than past tense. And you've processed a lot of things. And reading the book as well as a sort of chance for the reader to process their own things. Have you, I mean, I know I did, have you been approached by anyone to share their experiences or their fantasies or?
All the time. It's funny, the day job that I do is journalism. I make podcasts with my husband. We make long form narrative podcasts. And what that is telling people stories or helping people to tell their stories. And because it's podcasts, you know, I learned how to do audio here at BFM. You know, I learned the immediacy of it and the power of it here. And trying to make a space for someone's voice in a highly produced audio podcast is a discipline. You know, you've got to make sure that the voice is always front and center, whether they're talking about, I don't know, being part of history, like part of the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior in the Mr. Asia drug gang, whatever it is, or just their lives. So telling people stories is my favorite thing to do. You know, I see this stakes as part of that. Like, that's just part of that work. You know, it's me telling my story. But I'm always doing that. And I'm always wanting to do that. Like, if you've got any stories, if you're listening to this and you've got any stories, 021-213-4193. I love it. I love it.
Yeah. All right. Okay, a couple more questions before we let you go out into the world.
These are the best questions.
I know. Emma. Okay, who is your favorite Dracula, Noelle?
Oh, this is so hard,
isn't it? I'm sorry.
Okay, can I have two? Because yes. I have to say Max Schreck. I have to. You know, shout out to German neo-expressionism. Very important Nosferatu. Bram Stoker's wife tried to have the canister of film for Nosferatu burnt because she was such a terrier for his emotional, or sorry, his intellectual property as well as emotional. And I just say a little prayer every day of thanks that she didn't manage to do that, because I don't know where we'd be without Max Schreck. But I'm gonna go Gary Oldman, just because of time, space, you know, the 90s. That was my Dracula. Mm-hmm. Even though I hadn't a clue what he was up to initially, you know, like looking at those purple tinged glasses, the John Lennon glasses. That was a whole trip. Like,
and
that
the croissant haircut.
And as my friend Linda said, it looks like an ass on his head.
Yeah.
You know, that was the emblematic quote we had from that. But the costume design, like, absolutely impeccable. Yeah. Loved him. So he's going to be my second Dracula.
Yeah.
Who's yours?
I am quite partial to Bill Skarsgård in the recent Nosferatu, because he's so sort of syphilitic, but also really sexy.
Sexy man. Wasn't that
He's rotting, but quite erotic.
So erotic. And that final scene, my God. Dave Eggers.
I know.
Wow. Oh,
incredible. He's doing the Wolfman.
I know.
Werewolf, very soon. And do you have a favourite copy of Dracula? Do you have a treasured copy?
I have it. It's actually back in my hotel. It's a Penguin classic with a Munch, a detail from a Munch painting. Not the Scream one, like the Scream with a red-haired woman sort of battening on a man. And it is dog-eared and it's covered in washi tape because it's fallen apart and it's covered with Post-its. And it's the Dracula. It's the Dracula that I write about in Stakes, but also my most recent Dracula, which my daughter bought for me for my birthday. It's a hardback with marble pages. It's gorgeous.
Beautiful. And your own book is beautiful as well.
Thank you, Emma.
It is out now and you can get a copy at all good bookstores.
You can. And some are signed. The ones in Time Out in the women's bookstore should be signed for you.
Amazing.
Thank you, Emma Gleeson. What a pleasure. Thank you. It's an honour to be on Morning Glory.
Noelle McCarthy, an honour to have you. And we'll listen to another vampire song right now to sound us out.
Well, it's Halloween again, and LA is a bore. Everybody's looking like they wish they'd stayed inside. Now we're watching Frankenstein, and their beds and on their phones. Not me, baby. Tonight I'm really living. I'm a vampire again, and I'm coming for you. Open up your window, 'cause I'm about to sail in. You can call for mama, but she won't know what to do. I'm a vampire again. It's been a long time waiting, but I'm happy to be. I can smell you from 1,000 yards. Fresh white linen. Felt like only yesterday I was as weak as Woody Allen. Now I stand as proud and tall as the home you were born. I'm a vampire again, and I'm coming for you. So keep that window open. I'm a swooper and you know it. Cry for mama, but she won't know what to do. I'm a vampire again.
But it's me, babe. It's really me. It's your boy. I hope you've been keeping it sweet for me. Cause I woke up a hunger, midnight glory. I swear you won't feel a single thing into the year 2025.
Morning Glory.